Let me introduce you to Dr. Olivera Simic. Olivera Simic holds a number of degrees and qualifications from universities around the world. She's visiting professor at the United Nations University for Peace in Costa Rica. She's worked with a number of international organisations such as UNICEF and the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And as a legal consultant, she has a particular expertise in trafficking in human beings. She's working here in Brisbane and has written a book called Surviving Peace, a political memoir. She grew up in former Yugoslavia and witnessed her country fracture and dissolve. You've heard the phrase today, I'm sure. It's called the Balkanization of things. She was 19 years old when war broke out, and it's a hell of a story. Dr. Olivera Simic, good morning to you. So tell me when the process first started happening for you.
So I grew up in former Yugoslavia. I was born in Bosnia and Herzegovina, or Socialist Federative Republic of Yugoslavia, in 1973. And I think it's important to say when I was born, because the view on some of the things in political context and history is very also generational view.
So it's a very what generational?
Generational view in terms that I remember maybe differently from the generation of my father, what was Yugoslavia. So if you ask my father how he remembers Yugoslavia, his answer may be different. So that's why I'm saying I think it's important to talk about generations, also in terms of war, how do we remember war and how we think about war. So my memories of Yugoslavia in early 80s and 90s, that's where probably my memories start, were nice memories, and I have fond memories of Yugoslavia. I think Yugoslavia was very, if I can say, liberated country. We had a free education, free healthcare. My parents were middle class, as majority of people back then in Yugoslavia. They had a decent job. We could travel easily. We didn't need visas and all sorts of things, as probably our neighbors, not probably, but for sure, our neighbors in Eastern Europe needed. We could read the books coming from the West, listen to music such as Boney M and ABBA and Billy Idol, which I was very fond of.
The benchmark is always blue.
My teenage, yes, we loved Levi's and Star, Converse, and all this stuff. So, and I think that's important, because I know many of my friends who grew up in what was then Czechoslovakia didn't have that privilege to be exposed to all these different influences, cultural and other influences. So my memories were really nice and bright until 1992, actually, when everything started up to lead towards this collapse and terrible tragedy. So, and I was 19 years old back then. So I just finished my high school, and I had the plans to go to study in Sarajevo, in the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, because I had an aunt there. So these were my plans, and I remember that was in 1992, when I started to have these plans to go and study in Sarajevo, when my father actually told me that that probably won't be possible because there is going to be a war. So there was nothing.
How did he know?
I don't know. So I asked him that probably 2 or 3 years ago, and he never really gave me this straight answer. But at that time,
what, he could just generation, sort of feel it mounting, couldn't he?
Yes, he could feel that, but they knew, like, this is what I'm saying about generation. We had no clue. I was very young. I was 19, and I was not that involved in politics or interested in politics, as probably not many people in my generation at all. But he knew, because his generation started to, you know, form this multinational parties and talk about ethnic parties. So he probably became the part of one, or member of one of these nationalist parties, Serb party.
Yep.
So I guess they, of course, knew. I mean, nothing was sudden. It was sudden to me as a teenager. I won't say kid, but teenager back then. But it was not sudden to his generation.
Mm.
They must knew it. They knew well history, and they knew that after Tito died, you know, things were going rapidly towards.
Now let me ask you about Tito. He was a strong man, inverted commas. In other words, his dictatorial style rule, in one sense, either held those different groups at bay, or was able to buy them into his view of things, of holding the area together, or something else.
Look, to be honest, I I shouldn't call Tito a strong man. I don't think of him as a dictator in that sense. It's probably not many.
I'm trying to use that word without saying just dictator, because that doesn't adequately sum it up.
No.
He was a powerful force that was able to keep either a lid on or at least was able to manage the different other forces within the grouping.
So I think what he was brilliant at is actually keeping us in this, or having this lid and having some sort imposed of collective amnesia. So we never talked about crimes that happened, you know, during the Second World War or even not before. But certainly after the Second World War, we never had a chance to do as we now, to speak up openly, publicly or privately about these crimes. It was actually very prohibited. So during Tito's times, everything was really good. We had all these freedoms except freedom of expression and really freedom of religion. So now we have, so that's what we now say.
He dies and all of a sudden the lid is taken off all the discussion about it.
Yes. So when he died, we have freedom of expression, amazing freedom of expression in Yugoslavia, but we don't have anything else. That's what we like to say. You know, we traded off freedom of expression with all other human rights and freedoms. And once he died, all this idea about Yugoslavia died with him, and then we have this emergence of nationalist parties, extreme nationalist parties that will split three ethnic, major ethnic groups, Serb, Croatians, and Bosniaks across these ethnic lines, and bring them to these major ethnic parties.
In many ways, he was sort of a precursor to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the ending of the Cold War later on, wasn't he? It was almost like a warning indicator almost.
I think everything was sort of happening at the same time, you know, in 1990s, as we know, you know, Berlin Wall and collapse. So he was maybe what happened in Yugoslavia or started to happen was precursor what will happen in the rest of the Eastern Europe and the region, not just Eastern but Western Europe.
I'm interviewing Dr. Ilivera Simic about her book Surviving Peace, a Political Memoir. This is 612 ABC Brisbane. Steve Austin's my name. Now, I've spoken with a woman in Brisbane who has a different family story, Croatian background, and she tells a funny story of her dad despising Tito, you know, denouncing him, you know, rubbishing, you know, very strongly. And then much later on in life, looking back nostalgically and putting a photo of Tito up on the wall of the family house after hating him vigorously. Did that same thing happen in your family?
No, not in my family. I have to say that my family or my parents were diligent communist members, and I never heard actually anything against Tito. I never heard anything against Tito before war, during the war, or after the war. Actually, what I hear now and the story you are telling about your Croatian friend is not something unique to her parents or her father. So my father didn't despise Tito, but he is still nostalgic. So even he's now really nationalist, Serb nationalist, he is still nostalgic. So that shows you really complexities.
Yes.
How you can be nationalist at the same time nostalgic for Tito and really cry for those Tito times, you know, and saying, oh, we had a great life back then if you compare it with what we have now.
Yes. One of the chapters in your book, sort of telling your story, is the past is the present. How does the past invade or mould our view of something? There are so many examples of this around the world. The Middle East is an obvious one at the moment, but it's the same thing in the Balkan region. The past invades the present.
The past is a present, and I think it's hard, almost impossible to have this division between past and present for many people who are living or have been living through conflicts, as you see in Israel and Palestine, but also in the Balkans, who experience these conflicts on almost regular basis. Like every 30, 40 years, we have armed conflict in the Balkans. And we constantly go back and look back. We want to look forward to the future, but we look back to the past. Sometimes I don't think that we really live in present, because we are constantly molded with the past. Mm. And past really...
Because the past forms our view.
Exactly. The past is very important, how it forms our view in present and how it's going to form our views for future. So it's always there. It's present for most of us. Definitely in my life, it's just part of the daily life to think about the past, because I chose probably to do research very intensively in the past. But how it shapes present as well. So it's...
Can you give me an example of where it shapes the present? And it...
So, for example, what I do in my research, I'm looking at the past, meaning past war crimes, in particular looking at sexual abuse of men. Currently, I'm just writing a chapter on sexual abuse of men in the Bosnian war, the topic that is absolutely ignored and neglected.
I didn't hear anything about it.
Oh, yeah, there has been many cases, not, of course, that happened. Because we heard about sexual abuse of women, we never talked about sexual abuse of men. But there were cases before International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia about sexual abuse of men. So I'm just now looking at that topic. It's really interesting. It's interesting why we don't talk about it, about there is a taboo and silence. And, of course, it's about gender as well, why we don't talk about it and why former camp inmates reluctantly talk about. So... And I also look at the civil society, I look at the theater, I look at the arts, and I look how their performances, their street actions, how they take events from the past into the present, but not with an aim to inspire any revenge or hatred, but trying to, you know, build the peace and trying to strive to reconciliation. So they constantly look back and try to bring these stories that were neglected or ignored into the present.
Now, in my mind, why we study history or we look at the past is so we don't repeat its mistakes. We try and find a way of breaking that cycle. Now, anyone who studies the past knows we haven't done that. But what's your take on that?
I think that's very important. Of course, you know, we don't want to, you know, and if you hear former camp inmates, survivors of torture, rape, they will all say we don't want this to happen anyone again, you know, survivors of genocide. Everyone will say that. But it's also very important why we look at the past. It is because we don't repeat mistakes, but we also need to acknowledge what happened. That's very important to survivors, that they have this not just private acknowledgement between friends and allies, but they also need the public acknowledgement, and they need public acknowledgement from state that these crimes have happened.
So we need to be truthful.
Yes, we need to be truthful, and we need to say, yes, you survived this, and I apologize, or I acknowledge that you went through this. And this is what's missing in the Balkan area still, and what's missing in the other areas.
How is that missing in the Balkan area still?
Because state officials are not interested to publicly acknowledge what happened. And there are many examples, and one of the examples that I'm talking about in my book is the Operation Storm in Croatia that actually marks anniversary today. Yesterday marked anniversary. So
Tell me about Operation Storm. So give me the story of it.
I'll tell you a little bit about Operation Storm because I think it's an important story. It's a part of the history, and it's a story that has been neglected too, the story that no one has seen any punishment for the crimes that happened during the Operation Storm. So the Operation Storm was the biggest Croatian military armed force earth operation in Croatia, and it saw expulsion or ethnic cleansing of a quarter of a million of Serbs. We are talking about 220,000 hundreds Serbs expelled from the area in the course of four days, and they were Croatian government was organizer of that, and with support of the US as well. So recently, so these Serbs, and I witnessed this event because they were traveling from Croacia, through Bosnia to Serbia. Some of them still live in Serbia as refugees and IDPs. For this crime, in 2011, Generals Ante Gotovina and Ivan Markač were prosecuted, and they were sentenced.
So just say those names again for me, Slav.
Markač and Gotovina, Croatian generals, they were prosecuted by the ICTY. I think they received around 25 years of imprisonment for ethnic cleansing and criminal enterprise. However, that judgment was squashed just last year, and they were welcomed as war heroes in the capital of Croatia, in Zagreb. So no one is actually punished for these crimes. But that's not the worst, I would say, for it. It's the worst that actually this ICTY abolished the crime for what happened in Operation Storm and this expulsion of Serbs. It's also 2,000 of civilians dead.
Well, the International Criminal Tribunal.
Yes, International Criminal
in
Tribunal.
The Hague,
abolished
the crime.
Yeah, abolished because there was something wrong with the evidence that they couldn't prove. So they just said, this, we need to abolish them from the responsibility. And they were now free. They live in Croatia, and they were welcomed as
evidence was tainted or something?
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay. So that was the end result of the Operation Storm. So no one, and the end result is that August 4th is the day of the victory and national day, where the government of Croatia celebrates that day in the whole Croatia as a day of the victory, while in Serbia they mourn it as a bigger tragedy for Serbia.
Now, no matter what the people group and what the conflict, in my mind, whoever the people group or the conflict or the history, there seems to be in human nature a deep desire to be in the right, inverted commas, to be not thought of badly, to have thought to have done what was either right or justifiable under the circumstances. How do you see that as someone who sort of studies conflict and peace?
Yeah, and I think that's, unfortunately, I think that's an obstacle, actually. It's a very difficult, and it takes guts and courage to say I'm wrong, or we did the wrong stuff, or my people committed this terrible crime, and I feel sorry. There are people, of course, who do that, but they are minority. And I think that's very important, because it's obstacle, and that does not allow us to move forward and to reconcile and build peace. So we need to take responsibility for some crimes. We need to be truthful and say, yes, this happened. But not always to say, yes, this happened, but they also did this to us. I mean, that's one step to say, at least, yes, it happened. They did something to us as well. But
I heard that phrase used in relation to the Palestine-Israel conflict. And I thought this was quite good that they're actually talking a different ends, that the Palestinians want to win and the Israelis want to be right, and the two aren't the same thing. You know, they're talking at cross purposes all the time.
Yes,
that was how it was sort of put to me in that context, and it made a certain level of sense in my mind.
And also, I think that, and I talk about the role of victimhood pretty much, and I think that's very important, because I see that as another obstacle very much that in the Balkans as well. We can talk about Israel and Palestine as well, and other parts of the world with the conflict. Everyone thinks of themselves as the victims.
So, now, could you speak to that at the moment? That's quite fascinating. This happens both in sort of domestic scenarios and international scenarios, that what I'd almost see it as like the cult of the victim. If I show myself to be a victim, I seem to automatically have some sort of higher moral authority.
Yeah, it's not only that you have as a victim, you know, higher moral authority, and that you're always right, you can't be wrong as a victim. It gives you really this powerful role and status if you are a victim. But also importantly, that it just abolishes any sort of responsibility, because I'm a victim, therefore I don't want to engage in anything else because I survived this. I don't have any responsibility because I'm an exclusive victim. And that's what you can see very much in the Bosnia. Partially due, of course, you know, I mean, everyone will say that, we are victims as well. But this victimhood notion is pretty much reinforced by, you know, scholars, international community, who usually take sides, or often take sides. They take sides, you know. Either one side is guilty, or in the Bosnian War, Serbs were perpetrators and Bosniaks were exclusive victims. And then that created just this division, you know, and now Serbs think, okay, I'm a perpetrator anyway, so why would I reconcile? They anyway think about me as a perpetrator. That's what you can hear a lot, you know. So if they think about me as a perpetrator, let it be, you know. I can't help it, because that's something out. They see me, they can't change their view, so I just accept that. So that's also very wrong, of course, you know. But the role of victim is really, I think, if I may say, even dangerous one, because you just take this moral authority and you don't want to accept responsibility for anything.
So if you claim or lament your victim status, in our cultural debate, it absolves us of any sort of personal responsibility, even if it's true that we are a victim of something, when we sort of claim it as a mantle of some sort of righteousness, it absolves us from acknowledging our own responsibility in something.
Yeah, it just absolves you as any sort of responsibility, because you're a victim and you know, everyone else should be responsible towards you.
The problem is today everyone wants to claim that, don't they? I mean, it's the staple of TV news, books of stories. I'm a victim of insert people group or organization here.
Yeah, and it also gives you this always. You know, people say, "Oh, yes, I'm a victim," but but they also, as I said, they did this to me or they've done that. There is always this but, you know, and it's difficult to go over this and then say, "Yes, you know, we did this and this is wrong." It just maybe sometimes just finish there. We did genocide, Serbs committed genocide in Srebrenica, full stop. Of course, you know, we can say yes, you know, and then they will, you know, people will go and try to explain why that happened, and then, you know, they will invoke events that happened before, for example, Srebrenica, or, you know, happened 500 years ago. And it's never endless. Sometimes it seems just never endless. Or sometimes I just think, yes, we have to just admit something and say, yes, that happened.
So, I mean, but your point earlier to me was is that often people just want to be acknowledged. Doesn't matter what the side or who has the moral high ground. Yeah. Often people just want to acknowledge the truth that something happened.
Yes.
Just an acknowledgement.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right, I think, Steve, because I met a lot of survivors and talk a lot with survivors when I go back, and I feel people really feel they need their voices to be heard. They need desperately to be acknowledged. That's a one step. They need to be acknowledged as Aboriginal people here in Australia. Mm. Then you get this sorrow from the government. But then after acknowledgement comes something else. You need then something else. But you need first acknowledgement. That's absolutely true. And there are a lot of survivors, a lot of victims in Bosnia that have never been acknowledged. And the crimes that have been perpetrated against them have never been anywhere actually, you know, recorded so far.
Is there a little story you can tell for me on that, of where a crime has not been acknowledged, irrelevant of who the people group is?
Yes. So I mentioned the crimes against men. That's one interesting topic, for example, you know. And a majority of these men, that's, you know, evidence that we have, were Bosniak men who were in Serb camps. Just amazing torture that they had to survive, but a lot of sexual crimes, the forced incest, and I'm talking about men sexual abuse. So that's one of the topics that hasn't been explored that I'm currently looking at the moment, very intensely, looking at the testimonies of men and looking why we don't talk about. Another story that I'm writing also, another crime that hasn't been acknowledged because of this, you know, strong view that Serbs were only perpetrators and Bosniaks were only victims in the Bosnian War. There is a story about, and we talked about mass rape of Bosniak women mainly, right, by Serb forces. There are Serb women who were raped by Muslim forces in Croatia. There were camps that existed in the region in Bosnia, and there are around 100 women at least in one of these regions called Posavina, that's on the border with Croatia, where these women still live. No one has ever gone there to do interviews with them, to do any sort of research or scholarly analysis. And there has been some, except a part of women activists, a part of women organizations who publish there and there in booklets in local languages some of their stories. But it has never been taken up by the international organizations and scholars because they have been seen as women of the perpetrators group, you know what I mean?
So they were never asked?
Never asked, really. So there are these crimes, and they are still there, and they have, you know, they want to be acknowledged, and I interviewed a few of them, and I'm just currently writing the reports for the government of Republika Srpska for Gender Center about the crimes committed towards this group. So we acknowledge, it's not to deny, of course, mass rape happened, you know, systematically towards the Bosniak women. But there are other women who survived rape as well, who were not of that ethnic group, but we just ignore them because we have this victim perpetrators hierarchies and, you know, sexual crime hierarchies, and we tend to talk about, for example, white women rape, we don't talk about black women rape, we talk about women rape, we don't talk about men rape, etc., etc. So these are some of the crimes that haven't been touched upon still 20 years on.
My guest is Dr. Olivera Simic. She's from Griffith University. She's written a book called Surviving Peace, a Political Memoir. Steve Austin's my name. I have in my mind that BBC coverage of the Croatians in the camps during the Balkan conflict, and it sort of just struck me that you only got, in a sense, from sort of the BBC reports that were rebroadcast by us here in Australia at the ABC, you only really heard that Kosovo side. You have the same thing in Israel-Palestine today. You only get largely the Palestinian side from the BBC. And your point is that the claiming of victim status doesn't help move on or understand the scenario.
I think these are maybe two different things.
Okay.
Because I think this, what media can reinforce, and I think it's very important that we talk about it. I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk about, you know, camps or a particular side and all of these, that we need to do that. But if we constantly reinforce just one image, when then we create these divisions and we tend to reinforce just the image of one group as the victims and another of perpetrators, and that usually happens in most of the wars. We take, as I said before, we take take these sides.
That happens usually because a media organisation can get to often only one particular place. You know, often they can't get to other places. Like, I haven't seen an interview, there's been one interview with the head of Hamas, for instance.
Yeah.
It's because you can't interview them. Usually most journalists who try to get shot.
Yeah.
So you only get a certain slant, don't you?
That's partially right. That's partially true, because in Amnesty International last year, they published a report on sexual wartime rape in Bosnia and 20 years on and what has happened, etc. And one of their, and at the beginning of this report, when I read that report, they said that they wanted to interview all women from all ethnic backgrounds, but they couldn't find any Serb woman to interview. And that was really interesting to me, because I know at least 100 of them, Serb women who were raped, but they said they couldn't reach them. And I don't know, you know, there is a story in that I'm not sure if you can claim 18 years later that you can't reach some of these people. I mean, that's a bit, you know, the truth is that Serbs in Republika Srpska, Serb survivors are pretty angry at the Western world, and because they feel that that was absolutely unjust how they were represented as genociders only and perpetrators and not as victims at all. So nothing happens to them. So they feel really angry of this, you know, how they think of it, biased representations, and they... Sometimes they don't want to talk, sometimes they don't know language, sometimes, but more often there hasn't been really interest in this side of the story. At least that's what I hear from survivors and some women activist organizations. They said they never actually came to camps where Serbs were held. And there are, there were camps there where Serbs were held, of course, in Sarajevo, you know, Viktor Buban, and I know a man who was 3 years in that camp, Strahinja Živak, whose both sons were murdered by Croatian army. I don't know if international media and journalists have ever interviewed him. We all know about him, majority of people in former Yugoslavia, because he dedicated his life to write the testimonies of the people, Serb people who survived camps.
Before I let you go, the aftermath of the Balkan conflict was tragically the rise of international sex slavery from Europe. Mm. Have you had a look at that? Have you come across that at all? So after the death of Tito, the fracturing, or what we now call the Balkanization of all those states, you know, the breaking up of different ethnic nationalist groups to where we are today, led to apparently the rise of what we would call organized crime, and men from different parts of the region being very brutal in the running of prostitution. Can you address that at all?
Yes, for some time. So I worked in the beginning of 90s with the UNICEF, and I did lots of research on trafficking in women. So we're talking about trafficking here and organized crime, trafficking in humans and trafficking in women. And I've done my PhD thesis on UN peacekeepers. So when you talk about trafficking in women and international peacekeeping, pretty much this demand, peacekeepers created demand and market for prostitution, forced prostitution.
How?
Because in 1995, when the Dayton Accords were signed, we've seen tens of thousands of international peacekeepers, mainly men.
From
military,
where?
From all over the world. They came from States, from Canada, from UK, from Sri Lanka, and name it. So, you know, you peacekeepers come from all over the world as a contingent. Many of them military forces. And once they were stationed in the country, then we saw opening up of illegal brothels. They were not brothels because prostitution was and is still illegal in the country, but they were sort of dance bars. And they were stationed by coincidence, right, around these military stations or compounds and barracks of UN peacekeepers. And that's how it started to fuel the women from Eastern Europe, from Ukraine, from Romania, from Eastern Europe as well. They were coming there as a supply for these dance bars or actually as a sex slave. So for the few years, UN was looking at that very closely, and I was working with the Human Rights Watch in 2001 on on their report on trafficking in women, but looking at the UN peacekeeping and how peacekeepers influence that. And that's not something, it started with the Balkans and with the Bosnia. It actually started before that with Liberia, but it's still present. So that it seems that this organized crime follows the peacekeepers in the countries where they are stationed because there is demand, because you have a lot of males coming in.
Organized crime follows peacekeeping operations.
Yes,
because
yes,
a lot of
yes.
males away from home
yes.
is in a military base having to sort of do... keep a lid on a conflict.
Yes, you
and
know,
they become the purchasers.
And usually they are bored, you know, that's what the peacekeepers will tell you, because they are, you know, trained, you know, as a soldier, 80% of peacekeepers are military forces. They are trained for battles, for an action. Then they come to this peacekeeping operation, which they can't really use the force. They, you know, they can't do what they are trained to do. But that's one reason. Another reason is a very important reason, because that there is a lack of accountability for these crimes. They go unpunished because there is no... there is immunity. They enjoy immunity while in this country. So that's the number one probably reason, you know.
They have total immunity?
UN
peacekeepers?
Yes, they have
total immunity.
They have total immunity unless UN Secretary General waived that immunity. I mean, it's a very complicated story. But to make this story simpler, yes, they have an immunity. So they pretty much feel relaxed about what they do in the country, you know. And we have seen murders of, you know, rapes and murders. And also, you know, them engaged, not only engaged in an act with sex slaves, but also being involved in criminal networks. No one has been punished, except I know for one soldier, American soldier, but he raped an 11-year-old girl in Kosovo, in Albania, Albanian Kosovo. In 2001, and he raped her, and then he murdered her, and then he faced the martial court in the States, and he was imprisoned.
Mm. And is that sex trade still operating today?
Yes, but it's a different. It took a different form. Once the international left the region, it decreased, or it took a different form.
Okay.
Because now mainly locals are the buyers, and we don't have these dance bars everywhere around.
So, Dr. Simic, how do we survive the peace?
Yes. How do we survive the peace? I think people are doing various things to survive peace. I think that many, at least I can talk about myself and many of survivors that I met, many of my friends. Once you go through some things and once you survive the war and conflict or any sort of trauma, it just leaves these traits and it follows you through your life. It's just a matter of finding the ways and methods of dealing with some things. And I guess in my case, my method of dealing with some things is really writing about some of these things. It helps me, and I think a lot of people are doing arts, creative stuff, of course doing counseling or some other things that help them to go through some of these traumatic events and memories.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.